When the Lewis and Clark expedition arrived on the Pacific coast, they set up a camp for the winter about 5 miles south of present-day Astoria, Oregon. Interestingly enough, there was a bit of disagreement as to where exactly these quarters, dubbed Fort Clatsop, would be located. Finally, Captains Lewis and Clark ended up putting it to a vote, with both Sacagawea and Clark's slave York having an equal say in the decision. In the book Undaunted Courage, biographer Stephen Ambrose poses that not only was this the first vote ever held in the Pacific Northwest, but also the first time in American history that a black slave or a woman had voted. Now, I don't know how true that is, but what's not up for debate is that York did have an unprecedented amount of freedom during the expedition. Despite being a slave, York carried a rifle. He hunted game, helped to navigate, went on scouting trips, traded with the indigenous, and at times even helped to make critical decisions. Unfortunately, this freedom would not last. Once the expedition was over, York simply went right on back to being a piece of property. And unlike the other men, he was not paid for his time with the Corps of Discovery. Not one damn penny. Upon returning to civilization, York would ask Captain Clark for his freedom, but this request was denied. Per William Clark, quote, "I did wish to do well by York, but he got such a notion about freedom and his immense services on the expedition that I do not expect he will be of much service to me again." End quote. Now, York was married, but sadly, as was the case with many such unions in those days, his wife was owned by another man. Since Clark refused his freedom, York instead asked to be sent to Louisville, Kentucky, so, at the very least, he could be near his wife. Clark agreed, but only so long as it was a temporary trip. When York proposed that he could live there permanently and hire himself out, with the profits being sent to Clark, of course, this too was denied. When York finally returned from visiting with his wife, Clark felt that he had become insolent and sulky, so he, Clark, gave York what he described as a good trouncing, or in other words, he had him whipped. He also considered selling York to a quote-unquote cruel master, you know, just to teach him a lesson. While York would remain in William Clark's possession for the next few years, in the end, we do not know for certain as to his ultimate fate. During an 1832 interview, Clark stated that York was eventually granted his freedom and that he had gone into business for himself, transporting goods between Nashville and Richmond. However, once again, according to Clark, York, quote, "could not get up early enough in the morning. His horses were ill-kept, two died, and the others grew poor. He sold them, was cheated, entered into service, and fared ill. Damn this freedom," said York. "I have never had a happy day since I got it." He determined to go back to his old master, set off for St. Louis, but was taken with the cholera in Tennessee and died. End quote. So yeah, very sad story, but there is an alternate theory. Fur trapper Zenas Leonard would later write that on more than one occasion, in the early 1830s, he met with a black man living among the Crow Nation up in present-day Wyoming. Quote, "In this village we found a Negro man, who informed us that he first came to this country with Lewis and Clark, with whom he also returned to the state of Missouri, and in a few years returned again with a Mr. McKenzie, a trader on the Missouri River, and has remained here ever since, which is about 10 or 12 years. He has acquired a correct knowledge of their manner of living and speaks their language fluently. He has rose to be quite a considerable character or chief in their village. At least he assumes all the dignities of a chief, for he has four wives, with whom he lives alternately. He enjoys perfect peace and satisfaction, and has everything he desires at his own command." End quote. Now, full disclosure, there was a black fur trapper, Jim Beckwith, who also lived among the Crow around this same period. And there's a possibility that it was Beckwith who Zenas Leonard was talking about. After all, Beckwith was a notorious storyteller, and it's not out of the realm of possibility that he was going around claiming to have come west with Lewis and Clark. That said, he wasn't anywhere near old enough. At that time, Beckwith would have only been around 30 years of age, whereas York would have most likely been in his 50s, at least. In all reality, there's no way to know for sure if that was really York living there among the Crow, but damn it, I hope it was. I love the idea of him escaping bondage and returning west and just spending the rest of his life enjoying a freedom that was denied to him by so-called civilized society. By the way, my name's Josh, and this is the Wild West Extravaganza. You're listening to part 4 in a series on the Lewis and Clark Expedition. Link down below for the previous three installments, where we discuss the expedition's origins, Louisiana Purchase, and the Corps of Discovery's trek up the Missouri and west across the Rockies. In our current timeline, it's early December of 1805, and the men of the expedition are getting settled there at Fort Clatsop in present-day Oregon. And it's there where they'd spend the next 3.5 months, mostly just hunting elk, trying to stay dry, and of course, fornicating with the locals. Truth be told, bartering for sex with the indigenous was so frequent that Captain Lewis eventually had to warn the men to hold off due to the expedition running short of necessary provisions. Their various tools, axes, files, stuff like that, were all kept in the captain's quarters and had to be checked out and then checked back in immediately after use. The idea was to lessen the temptation to trade in such items in return for sexual favors. In time, they would also establish a salt-making camp some 14 miles to the south, where the town of Seaside, Oregon now stands. This camp was usually occupied by around 3 men, and they'd boil seawater in large kettles until the water evaporated, and then scrape the salt off the sides. Amorous pastimes and an abundance of salt notwithstanding, Fort Clatsop proved far inferior to the previous winter's quarters with the Mandan, mostly on account of the climate and a lack of variety when it came to food. You know how it gets up there in the Pacific Northwest. It rained nearly nonstop, and it was a next to impossible struggle just to keep men and equipment dry. The explorers all suffered from various colds, fevers, and the ever-present venereal diseases, and they were relegated to eating almost nothing but boiled elk meat. I think all total they consumed somewhere around 130 elk that winter. This was supplemented somewhat by dried fish and roots they'd purchased from the locals along with the occasional dog. But mostly, it was non-stop elk. Now, to be honest, that doesn't sound too bad, right? Especially if you're like me and you rarely have the pleasure of dining on elk. Then again, it's worth noting that this meat was almost never eaten fresh, or even roasted over an open flame. The men would often have to travel 2 or 3 days just to find game, and then, in order to preserve the meat, it was either boiled or jerked. Considering the wet climate, it was not an easy task to dry out the meat, so it was mostly boiled. Morning, noon, and night, nothing but boiled elk. And, well, I guess anything will get old if you have too much of it. Now, this is just anecdotal, but I remember a long time ago, maybe in my mid-20s, I didn't have enough money to buy groceries for about 1.5 weeks. Just broke as hell and in between paychecks. Luckily, somebody had recently given me a giant bag of venison tamales, the real kind, made by a nice old Mexican lady. And for about 1.5 weeks, all I ate was tamales. Look, I love Mexican food. If I can only choose one type of cuisine for the rest of my life, without hesitation, it would be Mexican. And these tamales were good, at least at first. But guess what? I ain't had a damn tamale ever since. To this day, I cannot bring myself to eat one. And that was just after 1.5 weeks. I can only imagine how the men of the expedition felt about elk after eating it almost exclusively for 2 or 3 months. And it wasn't just that it was boiled, but as I'm sure you know, elk can be extremely lean, lacking in fat. And these men were absolutely starving for fat. Per Captain Lewis on February 7th, 1806, quote, "This evening we had what I call an excellent supper. It consisted of a marrow bone apiece and a brisket of boiled elk that had the appearance of a little fat on it. This, for Fort Clatsop, is living in high style," end quote. Just the appearance of fat was enough to make note of. At one point, they had gotten word that a well had washed up on shore and set out at once looking to get some of the blubber. Sacagawea insisted upon joining the men, saying that she had traveled a long way to see the great waters, aka the ocean, and now that a monstrous fish was also to be seen, she refused to be kept behind at the fort. By the time they arrived, the natives had already stripped the well, but the explorers were at least able to trade for a little blubber, around 300 pounds worth. Enough to even bring out a little humor in Captain Lewis, quote, "Small as the store is, we prize it highly, and thank the hand of Providence for directing the well to us, and think him much more kind to us than he was to Jonah, having sent this monster to be swallowed by us instead of swallowing us as Jonah's did," end quote. By the way, big shout out to any new listeners or members of the Whistleverse who have recently discovered the Wild West Extravaganza, thanks to Simon and David over there at Casual Criminalist. If you're not familiar, Simon Whistler is probably one of the hardest working YouTubers out there. I think the dude has, at last count, something like 357 different channels. Now, I'm slightly exaggerating, but it's a lot. I have no idea how he does it. That said, if you're looking for some excellent true crime content, a lot of it historical in nature, then please do yourself a favor and give Casual Criminalist a listen. Link down below, and thank you, Simon. Also, let's not forget the great and powerful Dr. David Baker. One of Simon's writers, the guy in fact, wrote the glowing review of the Wild West extravaganza on a recent episode that he and Simon did about Bonnie and Clyde. Now, David's an interesting character. He's a damn alcoholic, first of all, but the booze does nothing to hamper his intellectual prowess. Lucky son of a bitch. In addition to being a writer and all-around pain in my ass, David is also a legit historian. According to him, he's one of the greatest historians alive today. And in addition to providing history fodder for YouTube, David is also an accomplished writer. I'll leave links down below to two of his books, The Shortest History of the World and Sex, 2 billion Years of Procreation and Recreation. I actually just ordered that one for myself. So yeah, big thanks to David and Simon. I really appreciate it. And I hope all you Whistleverse people out there are enjoying the show. Let's get back to Lewis and Clark. Now, as far as the interaction with the indigenous that winter, there was a steady stream of people coming to and from the fort. Most of these were local Clatsop, but they were also getting visited by other Chinookan people from further away. For the most part, relations were good, but this was somewhat strained by these coastal tribes being tough hagglers. Unlike many of the other nations that the expedition had encountered, these Chinookans had frequent contact with Europeans in the form of trading ships that would anchor off the coast each summer. As such, they weren't as equally impressed by the small trinkets that the Corps still had available. The men of the expedition had orders to treat the indigenous in a friendly manner, and they were forbidden from striking or assaulting them. If a problem arose, they were to give one of the sergeants, who in turn would find either Captain Lewis or Captain Clark and let them handle it. Now, recently a listener asked about an incident involving some type of thievery, possibly of Meriwether Lewis's own rifle, there at Fort Clatsop. And in response, Captain Lewis threatened to unleash a vial of smallpox upon the offending natives. He didn't have any actual smallpox, mind you, but the indigenous would have had no way of knowing that, and they soon returned the stolen item. Now, I had never heard anything about this, but I did look into it, as I promised to do, and was unable to find anything of the sort ever happening. As far as I'm aware about the most serious argument that occurred there at Fort Clatsop, involved some Chinooks traveling a long distance to visit the fort. Apparently, they had a strict rule of not allowing natives to spend the night inside the fort, so that evening, come sundown, Lewis ordered these visitors to leave. This irritated the Chinooks, and words were exchanged, but that's about the extent of it. Now, shortly before the construction of Fort Clatsop, when the Corps of Discovery had first made it to the mouth of the Columbia River, Private Shannon and Private Willard had spent the night with a small party of Chinook, and as they were sound asleep, the warriors did steal their rifles. Once the privates discovered what happened, they started making threats, and so did Captain Lewis when he arrived, telling the natives that if they did that again, he'd shoot them. There would be additional attempts at theft on the return trip to the Rockies, which we will soon discuss, and tempers would flare, but like I said, I was not able to find anything about vials of smallpox. If you know of such an occurrence, if this sounds familiar, and you've got a legit source, please hit me up at josh@wildwestextra.com. Finally, on March 23rd, 1806, the expedition began the long journey home. This parting, however, was not without controversy. Speaking of theft, Captain Lewis attempted, in vain, to purchase an additional canoe from the Clatsop. The Corps of Discovery was almost completely broke at this point, and the natives were asking too steep of a price, so, in a breach of etiquette, Lewis ordered some of the men to return at night and simply take the canoe, without permission and without payment. This doesn't sound like that big of a deal, but up to this point, the captains had dealt pretty squarely with the various tribes they encountered. Per historian James Ronda, this was a, quote, "sordid tale of deception and friendship betrayed. At worst criminal, and at best a terrible lapse in judgment." The essential honesty that distinguished Lewis and Clark from explorers like Hernando de Soto and Francisco Pizarro had been tarnished, end quote. I think also they were just ready to get the hell back home, especially after such a miserable winter. Patience, as you'll soon discover, was on short supply, and unfortunately for them, the misery was far from over. First, they had to contend with traveling back up the Columbia, rowing or sometimes towing their canoes against the current, carrying them and all of their supplies up and over the various falls, and all the wild game, even elk, proved to be elusive. To make matters worse, they were buggered by the Chinooks the entire time. Kind of. Always feel like I gotta add that disclaimer. This stretch of the river was relatively well populated, and these tribes were friendly for the most part, as they had been the previous fall. However, the natives, much like the expedition, were running low on food. Even Captain Lewis noted that they were almost starved. But still, oftentimes, they did trade what they could with the explorers. That said, these people weren't exactly operating a charity, and as such, they did drive a hard bargain. I'll say it once again, the Corps of Discovery was nearly broke. And when I say broke, they didn't really have anything to trade anymore. I think when they left Fort Clatsop, Lewis described their remaining stock of trade items as nothing more than a bit of ribbon and a few coats and robes. That being the case, they often couldn't afford the steep prices that the locals were asking when it came to food. I have to imagine that this led to at least a little animosity. And then, on top of that, some of the natives, upon whose land the expedition was crossing, mind you, began to steal from them. On the 6th of April, Lewis wrote in his journal catching one of the locals attempting to steal a piece of lead. Next evening, he caught another trying to sneak into their campsite, and yet another was even so bold as to try to take John Coulter's tomahawk right out of his hands. Relations were further strained a few days later when the indigenous began chunking rocks down on the men as they attempted to portage their supplies over the Cascades. But that ain't even the worst of it. On the very same day they were assaulted by those rock throwers, April 11th, someone managed to steal Lewis's dog, Seaman. Now this was damn near the straw that broke the camel's back. Captain Lewis sent out a few of the men to get Seaman back and ordered them to open up fire if the thieves even so much as offered up the least bit of resistance. Luckily, no violence was necessary and Seaman was returned, uneaten and unharmed. I don't know about you, but I hate it when my Seaman is unaccounted for. Finally, things got so bad that the captains decided to abandon the river altogether and make their way overland to the Nez Perce. To do this, though, they were going to need horses, and the only way they could get said horses was by purchasing them from the very tribes that were causing all this agitation. And remember what I said earlier about those steep prices. Nevertheless, mostly thanks to Captain Clark trading a little bit of doctoring, they were able to obtain 10 raggedy ponies. And by the 20th, they turned their backs on the Columbia River and began heading east overland. Not before burning their canoes, though. That's how angry Lewis was at the Chinooks. Rather than leave anything behind for them to use, Captain Lewis instead ordered it all piled up and burnt, even the paddles. And once more, things nearly took a turn for the deadly. Lewis caught one of the natives trying to make off with a small, insignificant item. I think it was an iron socket or something like that that came off of one of the discarded paddles. And he ended up putting a pretty serious ass-whooping on the man. Lewis then informed the thief's companions that he would, quote, shoot the first of them that attempted to steal an article from us, that we were not afraid to fight them, and that I had it in my power at that moment to kill them all and set fire to their houses, end quote. So yeah, patience was strained to say the least. And it was not over yet. A day or two later, Toussaint Charbonneau fell off his horse, and one of the natives tried to make off with his saddle pad. Lewis once more threatened to burn their homes down, and the saddle was soon returned. Once again, I know I keep saying this, but for what it's worth, these Chinookan villagers left no written journals of their own, so unfortunately, we only have one side of the story. And you know how that be. That said, once the Corps of Discovery left the river and began trekking east, they did start to encounter what they considered to be much more agreeable tribes, like the Walla Wallas and Yakimas. Ended up spending a few days with them, and a good time was had by all. Hell, the captains were even able to trade for additional horses. However much Lewis may have hated the Chinook, he felt the exact opposite about the Walla Wallas. Writing, quote, I think we can justly affirm to the honor of these people that they are the most hospitable, honest, and sincere people we have met with in our voyage. End quote. By May 5th, the expedition crossed into Idaho, and a week later, much to everyone's relief, they hooked back up with the Nez Perce, not far from the present-day town of Kamiai. Remember, they had left their horses with them the previous fall, and despite some infighting among two influential Nez Perce chiefs, these mounts were mostly well cared for in the interim. I don't think they ended up getting the entire herd back, but by the time it was all said and done, they would recoup around 20 or so of their ponies. That's the good news. The bad news is that they still had to cross the Bitterroot Mountains. And thanks to a pretty gnarly winter, the passes were still covered in snow and thus impossible to navigate. According to the Nez Perce, it would be at least another month until they'd be able to cross over, leaving the Corps of Discovery no other choice but to basically just sit around and wait. And speaking of waiting, I think this is a pretty good spot to go ahead and wrap things up for today. Before we go, though, I would like to discuss York just a little more and his relationship in regard to William Clark. You know, if you just look at Clark's resume, the dude really did have an impressive career. Veteran, war hero, famed explorer, and all that was just by his 35th birthday. We will discuss the rest of his life in the upcoming weeks, but even after the expedition, Clark's status would only continue to soar, both in fame and prestigious presidential appointments. Even nowadays, I think there are 4 separate universities bearing Clark's name, not to mention various counties in several different states. Hell, the man even has a damn nuclear submarine named in his honor. And then, of course, you have his inexplicable treatment of York. I've said this before, and I'll continue saying it for however long you feel like listening to me, but history is complicated. As an amateur student of history, one of the things I struggle with is how to properly view many of these historical people and events. And believe it or not, I do try to resist what's known as presentism, or looking at history through the lens of our modern-day standards and values. There are many people throughout the ages who accomplished some really amazing things, who also, at the same time, committed acts that nowadays we would consider evil. I'm hoping to do an entire episode on this topic one of these days. The pros and cons of presentism, the meaning of revisionist history, the prevalence of certain circles of academia to lean towards political activism, and just how to find a balance between the good and the bad when it comes to history. Honestly, though, I don't think there is a balance. History is non-binary. It just is. You know, we're always learning new things. We discover new information that changes what we think we know. But I don't think it's ever just black or white or good versus evil. History is just many, many shades of gray. My friend Michael over at the Texas History Lessons podcast recently recorded a very interesting episode around this same topic titled One Person's Activist as Another Person's Voice. Link down below in the show notes if you want to check it out. As far as York is concerned, I don't know what William Clark's inner monologue was like. While I'm fully aware that he was greatly influenced by being born into a slaveholding family that was deeply ingrained in a slaveholding culture, I still can't help but wonder if Clark ever regretted the way he treated York. Or did he just convince himself that it was all in York's best interest? I'm reminded of Thomas Jefferson, himself a slave owner and William Clark's boss, who in 1782 stated, "Indeed, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, that his justice cannot sleep forever." I don't believe that York ever did receive justice. Even if the story is true about him living among the crow and enjoying a freedom that the rest of us can only dream of, it's still no compensation for spending the rest of his life in bondage, nor for the beatings he was forced to endure or the indignities of his own wife being the property of another man. Currently, on the campus of the Lewis and Clark College in Portland, Oregon, there's a memorial to York titled York, Terra Incognita. At first glance, it's nothing special. Just a life-size sculpture featuring a bare-chested York, his rifle in one hand and a shirt in the other. It's the other side of the monument that contains the power. Circle around and you'll see that upon York's bronze back is carved a series of deep gashes, what appear to be whip scars at first glance, but when you look a little closer, the marks are, in all actuality, a map. A map of the Lewis and Clark expedition. Thank you so much for listening. We will be back next week with part 5 in this series on Lewis and Clark. Spoiler alert, someone's gonna die. Till then, do me a favor and head on over to wildwestextra.com and hit that contact button. Let me know what's on your mind. Did I leave anything important out? Was there something you wish I'd have spent more time on? Any questions left unanswered, at least thus far in this series on Lewis and Clark? Did I get anything wrong? Maybe you want to tell me that you fantasize about my voice sometimes when nobody else is around. Whatever. WildWestExtra.com or directly at Josh@WildWestExtra.com. All right, till then, don't go around threatening to burn anyone's houses down, okay? Don't steal anyone's canoe, and please, keep your eye on your semen. You never know when somebody's going to try to snatch it. Adios. son of a bitch.